Open up, if you haven't already, to Jeremiah chapters 9 and 10. And our goal is to understand here, get through chapters 9 and 10, and then to make some application here at the end. Again, this is the section of Scripture that we're in. As far as we know, this is part of the sermon that Jeremiah preached in the temple, in the temple complex. And he's standing there at the gates, and he's crying aloud to all the people who are coming in and out to worship Yahweh. And this is a difficult message. And we see and hear the prophet's grief and God's grief. And today we want to break into chapter 10 and talk about idolatry a little bit and then make some application. We notice that the culture of Judah was broken, that they were had no love for the truth, had no love for their brethren, had turned the blessing of their tongue into a weapon against their brothers and their sisters, and how God was heartbroken over that. God gives the reason for judgment because they had turned their backs. They had broken the covenant of the law that they made with God at Sinai, and they had gone after idols. We'll get into that some more in chapter 10. And so God gives a number of reasons for why they are going to be judged. And then this lament is raised in verses 17 through 22, where God instructs Judah's women, the wailing women, to teach their daughters not nursery rhymes, not songs of joy or mirth, but these funeral dirges and these laments and these wails, because death is coming. A crucial choice here is given to Israel, whether they're going to continue to pursue and boast in their wisdom and in their strength and in their riches, or to simply boast in knowing God. And we noted that this is the very thing that's at the heart of all of this, that they have refused to know the God of the Bible. They've refused to know Yahweh, even though He's reaching out to them, He's given them the prophets and the law. They simply do not want to have this relationship with Him. And so this judgment is coming. And then we ended here in the last couple verses of the chapter, verses 25 through 26. Now, Israel has been insulted quite a bit in this sermon. They had this improper reliance on the temple. And so God, you know, basically says you've been using this temple as some sort of like safe house that's going to keep you safe from this judgment in chapter 7 and verse 4. That's not going to save you. They had an improper reliance on the law. They thought because they have the law of God that they were, you know, somehow safe from judgment. And they actually turned the law of God into a lie. And here is sort of the final nail in the coffin, the final insult. And what does God call into question here in chapter, in verses 25 and 26? Okay, their circumcision. That's what we ended with on Sunday morning, their circumcision. First of all, what in the world is circumcision? It's without... maybe getting into too many details. I think we're all adults. We all know maybe physically what that is. But what was the point about it? What was the point of it? Yeah, Mark?
It's a sign to show that they were separate, different.
Okay, so you used a word there I think is really important. It was a sign. It was a sign to show that these people were different. It was a sign to mark them as a peculiar people. And again, you know, you see the sign for Old 36. That's not Old 36. That's just the sign for Old 36, right? You read the sign and it points to the real thing. And so this was just a symbol to point to something, a greater truth. And this is exactly what you said, Mark, this difference in them, that they were God's holy people. Now, the interesting thing here about these two verses is the rest of these nations that Jeremiah lists here, they all had their certain rites of circumcision. Circumcision wasn't peculiar just to the Hebrew people. A lot of these other nations had rites of circumcision. But what was different about Israel's was that God actually spoke to Abraham and told him to do this and told him what it was all about. That he was going to be their God and he would be their people and his descendants would be their people. So it was this mark of covenant loyalty of this relationship. Yes, Richard. Okay, so this is sort of where the rubber meets the road. It's a sign of a greater truth. And so what was going on was they were trusting in the temple, and they had perverted the whole purpose of the temple, which was the presence of God, you know. They had trusted in just possessing this book, the law, but yet they wouldn't follow it. And it's the same thing with this circumcision deal. And do we see that all the way up in the New Testament too? The Jews were depending on their circumcision. Well, you know, nothing's going to happen to us, right? You know, we're Abraham's children. We're the descendant of Israel, you know? And God's not going to judge us. So who are you, Jesus, to come here and tell us we have to repent? The kingdom is at hand, you know? They were trusting in their physical circumcision. Does anybody remember what John the Baptist said when these hypocrites were coming, these brood of vipers were coming to him at the River Jordan? You trust in Abraham as your father, yet from these... Yeah, these dead rocks over here. God can make living children out of these dead rocks. What was that in reference to? Who are the stones? Okay, yeah, Gentiles. Or maybe in general sinners, but certainly the Gentiles. You know, the Jewish people didn't think they had any spiritual life. Well, God can bring from these stones. Children of Abraham. So what Richard pointed out, I think, is important. This is the greater truth is here that their hearts would be circumcised. And this is exactly what Jeremiah told them in chapter 4 and verse 4. If you flip over there, he says, circumcise yourselves to the Lord and remove the foreskin of your heart, men of Judah and inhabitants of Jerusalem, or else my wrath will go forth like fire and burn with none to quench it because of your evil deeds. And so is the circumcision of the heart just a New Testament concept that the Apostle Paul... Now, this was always God's point, wasn't it? You see that back in those passages that we gave you there in Deuteronomy chapter 10, verse 16, chapter 3 and verse 6. That their heart was to be given over to loyalty to God. So, and then Paul gets into that again in various places. And Romans chapter 2 is a great passage. Romans chapter 2 in verse 25. Right in the heart of condemning the whole world under sin. You know, there's not one group of people that's special, that's immune to judgment. We're all sinners falling short of the glory of God. The Gentiles there, you know, they pursued all sorts of, you know, immorality and paganism and idolatry. But then in chapter 2, he goes, well, all right, Jewish people, now it's your turn. You know, don't feel too comfortable. You're also under sin. And he says in verse 25, for indeed circumcision is of value if you practice the law. But if you are a transgressor of the law, your circumcision has become uncircumcision. And so this is how in chapter 9, Jeremiah chapter 9, in verse 25, he can call Israel circumcised and yet uncircumcised at the same time. Any questions or comments about chapter 9 before we move into chapter 10? Okay. Chapter 10, we're getting into... idolatry is the main focus here, and really the final cost of idolatry. And God's people were creating these statues, and they were bowing down to them and worshiping these statues. Of course, a statue can't answer a prayer, and so their prayers went unanswered. They went unsaved. But it's worse than that. You know, their lives are changed by the worship of these things. And so let's look at this first section here. Verses 1 through 16. Are idols, and I have a tendency to give you loaded questions that hopefully cause you to think and that might cause you to go elsewhere other than this immediate text. But in your understanding of the Bible and these Canaanite religions. Are idols real or are they imaginary? Okay, Charles says they're real. Okay. Anybody else? Linda.
The figures that they make are real things.
Okay.
But the power and what that God can do is all in their mind.
Okay. Okay, so the answer is yes, I guess. Yeah. They're real, but they're not. Yeah, did I see a hand back here? Yes. Right. Yeah, I think that's a good way of stating that as well. Did someone else have a...
I was going to say the plagues of Egypt, those are all pointing to their idols. The sun, the moon, frogs, flies.
Yeah.
And they had idols, all these things that they had some superstition belief that they believed that these things could do things to them.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting how God has made us. The preacher in Ecclesiastes says that He has put in eternity in the hearts of men, and so there's something within us. It doesn't matter what culture that you're in. If you're a student of history, you can see. I mean, I think just across the board, every culture, every civilization has their version of deity. You know, has their thing or their person or their idea that they worship and they rely on and they trust. And so humanity is working out all of these different ways to reconcile the fact that, you know, there's got to be something bigger than just us. I mean, we didn't make this world, you know. And yet, you know, the time we're living in, that might be exactly what people are saying. That there isn't anything bigger than this. But every culture seems to have their idols. And it's their way of making sense of the world. And we have our idols too. And so even though these things are imagined, they're not gods. In fact, in the Hebrew, the Old Testament, when you see that word idol, I thought there's just one word for idol. There's like 15 words that are translated idol. And none of them are nice words, by the way. They're all very derogatory. I'll just read you some, I don't know how to pronounce them, but what they mean. So sometimes when you see the word idol translated in the Old Testament, it might be the word for nothingness or vanity. That's the word that's used here. Or thing of naught. A nothing. A no thing, you know. A terror or a horror. Shame. Dung, filth. These are the kind of words that they use to translate idol. And so none of them are very complimentary, but these are no gods, no things, no God things. They're not gods, and yet they're worshiping Him, and they're worshiping them. And it's subtle, because sometimes I think the Old Testament prophets really have a good time making fun of this, don't they? What does he call the idol? What does he liken it to in verse 5? Possibly the greatest description of an idol, I think, in the Bible.
A scarecrow
in a cucumber field, right? So the idea is that they would take these elements from the earth that God has made, and that they would pour it into a mold, or they would carve it, or whatever, and fashion it, liken it to this God, and then they would worship it. Yeah.
Yeah. You think of that image of the scarecrow.
Yeah.
And why does the scarecrow do any good? Because it fools the birds. They think it has power.
Yeah.
You know, we make scarecrows to kind of look like people.
Mm-hmm.
So the birds think, oh, these are people, they have power. Well, an idol is much the same way. If it fools somebody into thinking it has power,
yeah,
and in this case, the person themselves is his fools. It's not that the idol has done anything.
Right.
You know, what Susie said, I thought was right on. It's
yeah.
In the mind of the one who's worshiping it. That's the only power it's got.
Yeah, it only has power if we give it power
right.
over our lives. Yes. Mo.
We had maybe more of the two kinds of rules they made up for these idols. One of fear, that if you don't worship this God, he'll kill you.
Yeah. Right, and what Moe's referring to, if you didn't hear him, is, you know, there's two sides to that. You know, the god Moloch. Oh, you know, Moloch might come down in wrath and send a tornado or like a hurricane or something. That's what leads these people to sacrifice their children. Literally, they would take their children, and they would put them on this bronze altar, and they would burn them with fire. Okay, and people ask, well, God is so mean for driving out those Canaanites. This is what these people created in God's image were doing. They were taking their children and they were offering them on this altar and burning them with fire. And Israel was doing it too. So there's this fear, and then there is also, you come in, I don't know about in the Old Testament with these gods, but with the Greek gods and the Roman gods, what Mo was referring to, they'd have these temples, and to go worship, like we're coming together to worship God, you know, to go worship God, They would literally go into the temple and be immoral, sexually immoral, with these priestesses, and they were essentially prostitutes that worked in the temple, and they would have shifts, and they would come in and out, and that was part of their culture. And so, do idols have power? Only if we give them power, but they're so subtle, and sometimes we miss it, brethren, when we look in the Old Testament, and we just think, well, an idol is just like a statue. It's an idea. It's an ideology. Like the Greek gods, you know, Aphrodite, I forget which one she was, like fertility and wisdom or something like that. They were just ideas that the culture held dear. And then they personified that idea and they made it look like a scantily clad woman. And they worshipped it. And so what God is doing is trying to get through the heads of his people here through this section, verses 1 through 16. Let me compare myself to these gods that you're worshiping, and you'll see. And if anyone ought to know, it should be Israel. If anyone ought to know how powerful God is and how powerless the idols were. What reason does Jeremiah give for Israel not to fear these idols? Don't fear these idols. Verses 5. Just like that scarecrow. Yeah, just like that scarecrow. Yeah, they can't harm you. They're not the ones sending the hurricane on you because you were naughty. And they can't do any good. They can't save you either. And so don't fear them. Don't give them any place in your heart. Don't pray to them. Don't feel like there's anything there. They are no things. They are not God things. What about in the second section here? Manufactured objects versus... Whoops, I'm behind a little bit. Versus the eternal king. What does it say of someone who takes their instruction from an idol?
They are altogether brutish and foolish. Stop. It's the doctrine of vanities.
The doctrine of vanities. Well put, yeah. Brutish and foolish, or stupid and foolish. If you're going to take your life and shape your life and how you're going to make decisions and how you're going to treat other people and all this and, you know, all of that, and you're going to take your instruction from this block of wood, then you yourself are just as brutish as, you know, as the graven image that you're giving yourself to. So you, and again, he talks about, you know, beaten silver is brought from Tarshish and gold from Uphaz in verse 9. The work of a craftsman and of hands of a goldsmith. Violet and purple are their clothing. They're all the work of skilled men. They might be pretty. You can dress it up in nice clothes and you can make it look very expensive, but at the end of the day, it is brutish or it is stupid, it is foolish. And just like that scarecrow, it's deluding people into thinking it has power. But there's no delusion with God. God is not false. God is true. God is not dead. He's the living God. God is not perishable. He can't be burned up in a fire. He is the everlasting God. And God will answer your prayers. And He will have a great effect on your life if you pray to Him, because He can actually hear you. And He can do something about it. He's not impotent. You know, He's omnipotent. He can break into this creation He's made, and He can change things in this world for you and for me. And He can save us if we have faith in Him. What about verses 11 through 15? These idols that are doomed to perish, this creator of the universe. If idol statues exist within the created order and did not make the created order, what are they subject to? Man, that's a wordy sentence. I'm sorry about that. Oh, man. It makes sense when I write these things. I hope they make sense to you.
Destruction.
Yes.
Destruction.
So they're subject to destruction, to failure, to being subject to the elements or being burned up. I mean, right? Just on a basic level, they're doomed to perish. They're perishable by nature. They're not everlasting like God, who is everlasting. And when you think about it, that's true from a physical standpoint, but it's also true from, I don't know, like an ideological standpoint. Where are the gods of Egypt now? They're not here, you know. Where are the gods of Greece now? You know, we make plaster casts, we make statues of them, but they're not here. Nobody's worshiping them now, you know. Where are the gods of Babylon and Assyria and Rome? You know, in their day, they seem to be powerful. In fact, in the book of Ezekiel, the exiles were asking this question. As they were taken away into Babylon, they were taken away from their home, they got to thinking, maybe the Babylonian gods are greater than our God. If they were able to take us, you know, but where are they now? They seem to be powerful. They're all gone. And the only God that stands today is Yahweh, or the God of the Bible. The living, true God. Verses 14 through 16 then. Worthless frauds versus the God of Israel. Why are idols deceitful? We touched on this a moment ago. But what did you have written there? Why?
They give false hope.
Okay. They give false hope. Anyone else have anything other than that? Yes, Linda? All right. Yeah, they're objects of shame because their claims are fraudulent. They offer false hope, at least in the minds of these people. They think these prayers are going to be answered. They never answered the prayers. And then the people are destroyed, you know, saying, where are you? You know, where are you, this God or that God? Mike?
This whole section here is showing a contrast between Jehovah God and these false gods in here. Your last question, how do they exist? If they're made, you have to make them. And then he follows up with, I made the earth. My power has made this.
Yeah.
Who are they subject to? They're subject to my laws, my creation.
Yeah. Yeah. Human beings have to fashion these things and go through these elaborate, you know, work. These craftsmen have to go to school to learn how to, you know, do this. I made the craftsman. I made the ore in the earth that you have to. Yeah, exactly. So again, he's just pointing out how foolish it is, and Israel really ought to know this. But he's really setting up that contrast. How is Israel God's inheritance? He says in verse 16, the portion of Jacob is not like these, and that's God. For the maker of all is He, and Israel is the tribe of His inheritance. The Lord of hosts is His name. When I think about inheritance, I think about what we get. or what Israel would get. Their inheritance was like the land of Canaan, you know, the wells they didn't dig and the, you know, fields they didn't plant and houses they didn't build. Like, that was their inheritance. And we come into the New Testament, right? What's our inheritance? What's our spiritual inheritance? Yeah, heaven, the promised land. Yeah, that's the parallel. But here we've got we've got Israel as God's inheritance too. What do you think?
Israel is God's people, and they're God's people because He chose them to be.
Yeah.
Not because of anything that they did, but because He chose them to be.
Yeah, in fact, just the opposite, right? God, through Moses, tells them, when you get to that land, make sure you don't start thinking you're better than the people I drove out. You know, He says you're stiff-necked and you're rebellious people. But He chose these people to be His, and He has His own reasons for that. But Israel is His inheritance. Out of all the world, here's this tribe of people that belongs to God in a special way. All the world is His. But He chose Abraham and Isaac and Jacob after him and the descendants from there. And okay, Linda.
I thought of it from the standpoint of a father giving their children, their son, their name, and he named them.
Yeah.
He named them Israel.
Yeah. You are my children. I have named you. Yeah. Isaiah 45. Yeah. So the point of Israel was to show the glory of God, to show all of these other people who were busy chasing after the divine through these worship of other idols. God says, I'll make a lesson with this people, with my inheritance, with Israel. They'll worship me. They'll learn about me. I'm righteous. I'm holy. I love them. And they'll be righteous and they'll be holy and they'll love their neighbor. And so through their actions, I'll be glorified. Except that's not what's happening. Okay, now take that concept in the New Testament. Is that not our mission? Are we not the new Israel? Yeah. We are the spiritual Israel. And our circumcision is not physical. It's of the spirit. It's of the heart. It's what God is doing within us. And so when people who don't believe in God, when they work with you, and they say, you know what, Troy, he's an honest guy. Like, he's not going to run his business like I run my business. He might ask why. And Troy will tell them, well, it's because of the God I worship. And so, it's a reflection of the character of God in the way that we live our lives. So it is with, that's the way it should have been with Israel. That's the way it is with us. In fact, if you go over to Ephesians chapter 1, Paul says in verse 13, he says throughout this chapter that the creation of the spiritual people was to be the praise of the glory of His grace. Verse 13, he says, in Him, that's in Christ, you also, Ephesians, after listening to the message of truth, the gospel of your salvation, having also believed, you were sealed in Him with the Holy Spirit of promise, who is given as a pledge of our inheritance. We're given the Holy Spirit as a pledge of our inheritance, what God has promised to us, with a view to the redemption of God's own possession, to the praise of His glory. And so we've got our inheritance in heaven. God has His inheritance with us. Right? We are God's own possession. Out of all the peoples in the world, it's the Christian nation. It's the new Israel. It's the people who are devoting their lives to this God. Better keep moving here. What's the irony of being slung out there in the next section? Here they followed these idols, and God is, He's going to sling them out of this nation, of this area, region of the world. Go ahead, Richard, and then David. Right. Yeah, he vomited them out. He slung them out. He dispossessed those nations. Now he's going to do the same thing with Israel. Were you going to say something different, David?
Yeah, I mean, the scripture reference you gave was the context of that. You know, Abigail was coming to David trying to correct what her worthless husband had done. And in that, she says to David that, you know, the lives of his enemies would be slung out. And, you know, this was really a message from God.
Right.
But the irony is now God's going to sling out, you know, his people, Judah.
Yeah.
Because they are now worthless.
Right. And again, as Mo pointed out, they ought to have been a blessing to God, a reflection of God's goodness to the world, and now they've become like an enemy. So they'll be slung out. And what must Jeremiah bear in verse 19? Yeah. His wounds. Yeah. His grief, sorrow. Yeah, those emotional wounds. And so this is just a sad picture. You know, the portion of God, the inheritance of God, what should have been the blessing to the world, they're shown, pictured here, just packing up their bundles and their tents. And they are leaving the city because it's under siege. And so now they're nameless, they're hopeless, and they're futureless refugees. And because they exchanged the truth about God for a lie, they become like the nations around them. And so they're going to be slung out, vomited out of that land. Richard. Yeah. At this point, it's too late. Yeah, and we've been seeing that in these last couple chapters. Yeah, there's really nothing left to do but wait until the invasion comes from the north. Sound of a trumpet, the sound of a report, behold, it comes, a great commotion out of the land of the north to make the cities of Judah a desolation, a haunt of jackals. And we come to the final section here of the chapter, where there is a prayer of Jeremiah after observing all, you know, Judah's history of idolatry and rebellion. What was the prophet's conclusion in verse 23? It's a classic verse. And when you set it in this context, it really comes alive, I think. Yes, Rodney. When we do things our way, when we don't appeal to a holy God to guide us, we just make a mess of things. It's not within us to guide our own steps. It's not part of our makeup. When we do, we just ruin things. Yeah. It's a classic verse. I know, O Lord, that a man's way is not in himself, nor is it in a man who walks to direct his own steps. And then he makes a plea. And what's that plea in the next verse? He calls upon God to correct him. And what else? Okay, with justice and not anger. In mercy, in other words. In mercy. With justice and not anger. And so if there's going to be punishment coming, then he pleads for God to be merciful. You know, when I say, Simon, you know, you're gonna get spanking, you know, for this. And is it gonna be a big one or a little one? Yeah. So it's the idea. This is gonna be a disciplinary action and not destructive. That's what the prophet is saying. Don't just utterly wipe us out. You know. If this is gonna come, don't utterly wipe us out. One of my favorite books is the book of Habakkuk, and Habakkuk is in a similar situation where he's waiting for justice, judgment to come, and God reveals that it's going to be Babylon, and Habakkuk's like, what? You know, how could it be Babylon? They're even worse than we are. How could you use these people? And so finally God explains to them why and how he's working all this out, you know, and Habakkuk at the end of the book, he comes to just completely trust in God, and he says in chapter 3 and verse 2, in wrath, remember mercy. In wrath, remember mercy. That's sort of what Jeremiah is saying. Should we have that attitude too when Jesus comes back to this earth? He will come back. Yeah. In wrath, remember mercy. And then finally, in verse 25, he has this last request for justice. And did you notice any irony there? Let's read that. Pour out your wrath on the nations that do not know you, and on the families that do not call your name, for they have devoured Jacob. They have devoured him and consumed him and have laid waste his habitation. Any irony in that? A little bit, just a little bit, yeah. What is it? Huh? Yeah. Yeah. So his plea is, you know, pour out your wrath on the nations that do not know you. Who doesn't know God here? Israel, Judah. They refuse to know God. Chapter 9 and verse 3, chapter 9 and verse 6. And so they're going to, the wrath of God will be, in fact, poured out on them. Yeah.
And another irony in that, Jeremiah had this plea for justice, but certainly Judah did not practice justice, even among themselves.
Yeah, exactly. So we don't have a whole lot of time left, but I think we can make a few application points, maybe just one or two. What did you guys get for the first question there in this section? Going back to chapter 8, how can we make the law of the Lord into a lie? That's what Israel had done in chapter 8, verses 8 and 9. They possessed the book of Deuteronomy, they possessed the law, and they made it into a lie. But bring that into 2017 in Danville. Any way we can do that? And if so, how?
Taking the name of the Lord thy God in vain.
Okay, taking God's name in vain. Okay. David? Right. Mo? Yeah, I mean, having this book is great. It's a blessing, but it's not going to benefit you. It's not going to be a blessing to you if you don't read it and study it and see yourself in it and say and make the changes that are necessary. And that's what Israel failed to do, and that's we can also fail to do that. Right.
Also make it a lie by adding to it.
Ah, yeah, we can make it a lie by changing it. By preaching a message that's distorted in some way, or by ignoring certain things that God has revealed. Yeah. And so, you know, if you're in search for a church community, and you know, I need to go to a congregation somewhere that, and you love the truth, and you want to be changed, and you want to be part of one of these congregations, you need to seek one out that's teaching the whole counsel of God, that's teaching the truth. And so don't be lulled into the fact, you know, I've got this Bible, I'm good to go. That's not what's going to benefit you. It's going to benefit you if you avail yourself to it in all of it. And in all of its simplicity and purity, without adding to it or taking away. One thing I have written down here is, I think we can make the law of the Lord into a lie when we're very vocal on one issue while we neglect this one over here, you know. When we're ignoring what Jesus calls the weightier matters of the law. You know, do we denounce greed and injustice and lying and corruption with the same fervor that we do sexual sins? We need to be honest about that. Do we claim to have, you know, a high respect for biblical authority, but we behave in a very unbiblical way in our daily lives and how we treat people when you go out to eat or whatever, or when you pay your taxes or this kind of thing? We can turn the law of the Lord into a lie. Anything else y'all wanted to add? That first one? Okay. We'll see what 30 seconds will get us here. How can we heal the brokenness of God's people superficially? That's exactly what the priests and the prophets were doing in Jeremiah's day.
All
right. Preaching the same kind of message they were preaching. Linda? Yeah. So this is the idea that, you know, come worship God on Sunday, and we'll tell you how great you are. And we'll tell you how everything is just the way it's supposed to be, and everything's going to turn out right. But again, we've got to preach the whole counsel, all of this, and to be changed by it. And so there's a lot of peace in there, but we need to preach the whole deal. So thanks for your comments. Appreciate it.